One, I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today, the truth about what has been happening in the Middle East. This is an interview with one of the outstanding independent journalists in the world, Eva Bartlett. She's been being interviewed by John Roberts, and it all revolves around her perspective, having been on the ground, seeing the activities. And now we can look back on this interview and say, wow, she was ahead of the curve. She got it right. Even the gray zone with Max Blumenthal and The Intercept and other reporters, independent reporters, have now been able to come forward showing that virtually everything that the United States, the State Department, the intelligence community, the Pentagon was saying about Assad in Syria, firing on his own people, gassing his own people, all that was wrong. We have hard evidence. Even a congressional, or not a congressional, but a UN inspection came to that decision just this year. So we were lied to, we were propagandized by the very same neocons that got us into the Iraq fiasco by lying to us. None ever held accountable, by the way, including the person at the New York Times, Judith Miller. Nothing ever happened to her where she had to pay a consequence because of being wrong. And here we are. The New York Times, Washington Post, all of those who participated in that big lie about Iraq and Libya and Honduras and Ukraine, all of these are lies. This is just one of the activists that I just want to commend, Eva Bartlett. She's appeared on this show about 10 times. This is an older interview, but I thought after listening to it and Jesse from PRN listening to it, you would find it of interest. Now to Eva Bartlett.
Well, thank you very much for that kind applause. You probably know this, but there are many people, non-Syrians, who are in solidarity with Syria. I think that's a bit too close now. There are many people who realize that what's happening in Syria is an unjust war against a sovereign nation and have been standing with the people of Syria, the army of Syria, and the people's choice for their government. For years and continue to stand with Syria, in spite of the machinations of the media, of Western leaders, of Gulf leaders, of so-called human rights groups. People see through the lies. While I'll be addressing Aleppo to a large degree tonight, I will be drawing parallels with other areas of Syria, including places I've visited. Just for some brief background information, I'm both Canadian and American. I was born in the States, grew up in Canada, spent a lot of time in occupied Palestine, and when things started in Syria, I felt like something was wrong in the sense that what we were hearing on the likes of Al Jazeera or corporate media was not telling the truth. And it turned out many of us were right when we felt that something was amiss. I started following independent media, blah, blah, blah. Later in 2014, I was able to go to Syria for my first time. And while I'd at that point read quite a bit and had a fair idea that what was happening in Syria was a premeditated war against the people, trying to depose the Western nations and Gulf nations, you know, the NATO alliance with Turkey and Israel, trying to depose the elected president, when I went to Syria, that was... when I went to Syria, that's exactly what I heard from people. I've since been back 5 more times, so 6 times in total. I applied for visas and waited and paid for the visas, and I just make that point always because there are some people who refuse to hear the truth about Syria, and they look for any means to try to discredit one who speaks truth about Syria. And one of those means is to say, you know, you're being paid by Russia, you're being paid by Syria, and that's not the case. In this summer, I spent a couple of months in Syria, and during that time, I went for my first time to Aleppo. And Aleppo was a place I'd wanted to go to for a while because it has been one of the most lied about and also ignored cities in Syria. And I say ignored because while you will find Aleppo in the media, usually they're talking about eastern areas of Aleppo that were occupied by terrorist factions. And at this point, I might just pause and say, were occupied by terrorist factions. Because as you're aware, Aleppo is almost completely liberated. There have been kind of facts bandied about, but the last concrete figure I heard was that 93% of these areas that had been occupied by terrorist factions since 2012 have now been liberated. And so this means that peace will eventually be coming to Aleppo. And I have to note, on that note, just today I got a message from a friend of mine, Pierre, a Frenchman who's living in Aleppo and doing extraordinary humanitarian work there. The bombing is still happening. The terrorist bombings are still happening. So yesterday, 19 people were killed, civilians, and 150 injured. And this is the type of thing that's been happening for years to deaf ears in Western leadership, so-called human rights groups, and the media. You're probably all pretty aware of the dynamics of Aleppo. You know, it's the second largest city in Syria. It was the industrial hub. And it didn't immediately, the people of Aleppo pretty much rejected this so-called revolution and went about their lives and supported the government. And then the hell of the Western foisted revolution came to Aleppo in 2012. And with it came a series of kidnappings of people, of the destruction of the industry, both destruction of factories and theft of factories, thanks to Turkey's Erdogan, who basically just opened the highway, opened the gates, probably instigated the theft, certainly allowed large machinery to be trucked from Aleppo and into Turkey, depriving the people of Aleppo of their industries. So this was a major hit against Aleppo's economy and Syria's economy. And then on top of that, you had periods of siege over the years when, you know, the sole highway going into Aleppo was no longer the main highway, but was a simple, much smaller highway to the east that at times has been cut off by militant factions, meaning that people are being deprived of food and medicine and everything that was coming into Aleppo from outside. So this is a notable point because Western media, corporate media, only talks about sieges, blaming the Syrian army and government. There have been sieges, but there's a reason for the sieges. And the reasons are the terrorist factions within these eastern pockets of Aleppo and formerly, you know, northern pockets and southern pockets are on a daily basis until now, as I mentioned, firing a variety of missiles, including Grad missiles supplied by the West. Mortars, gas canister bombs, water heater bombs, explosive bullets, and pretty much anything they can concoct and fire on the 1.5 million people of Greater Aleppo. And so on a daily basis, you have tens, sometimes 20s, you know, sometimes even over 100 people, as earlier this year, killed in a single day. And we won't hear about this in the corporate media because it doesn't serve the agenda of the media of the West, which is to overthrow the elected president. And to do that, they need to get Western support to believe, Western people to believe, that the president alone is killing his people. And the army, of course, is killing the people. This is the narrative. But if you actually go to Aleppo and you talk with people, the majority of them support their president and army. And they say, as all over Syria, it's not about our president. What's happening here is terrorism. What we're doing is fighting terrorism. This is our sovereign right to do so. And just if you juxtapose this situation onto, say, America, how would people in America react if a pocket of terrorists suddenly started firing on a city? We'll take Boston. I don't know the neighborhood of Boston, but if there's an area that was inhabited by militants or extremists and they started firing on the city, definitely they would be eliminated by whatever special forces you have in America, right? I mean, it's clear. But when it comes to Syria, and you have terrorists coming from over 100 nations over the years, and attacking and slaughtering and beheading and mutilating and destroying, somehow the Syrian people are supposedly at fault for defending themselves. This is how the Western narrative has gone. So I think another important point is that the Syrian army is not Assad's army. It's the Syrian army. The Syrian Arab Army is its formal name. And they're not the only ones defending Syria. There are local defenders. You take Maalula. Maalula, local Christians took up arms to defend against extremists the West was funding and supporting. And Maalula, as I'm sure you're all aware, is an ancient and historic town that was devastated by 8 months of occupation and destruction by these terrorists, and works hold until now by the likes of Democracy Now!, by the likes of New York Times. We're told that these are freedom fighters, that these are bringing people democracy and freedom. And every Syrian I've met has said, what democracy is this that destroys our heritage and murders our people and imprisons our people? With regard to Aleppo, in addition to the daily bombings and the theft of the factories and the sieges, there have been a variety of lies told about Aleppo, and I've already touched on them, the lies that the army is killing its people or that the government is killing its people. Another main lie told about Aleppo and other areas in Syria before, which are now completely forgotten because they no longer serve the purpose of the regime changers, is the myth that the government is starving its people. I'll hearken back to the example of Madaya, a district outside of Damascus. And in January or so, early January this year, overnight, every single major media, corporate media, was talking about Madaya. And every, you know, major human rights group, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and so-called anti-war activists like Code Pink. They were all talking about Madaya. They were all saying the Syrian government is starving the people of Madaya. And they didn't care that the Red Cross spokesman had said in October 2015, 3 months prior, the Syrian government facilitated and allowed in aid enough to last for 3 months. So 3 months later, January, and people are suddenly overnight starving. And everybody's blaming the Syrian government. When in fact more aid got in, so again, Red Crescent, Red Cross, and the UN, and some independent journalists got in, and Russian media got in, and Syrian reporters got in, the testimonies they took, the people in Madaya were saying, there was always aid here, but we couldn't access it, because the terrorist factions within were stockpiling it. There was always food, but we couldn't access it, because the terrorists within were stockpiling it and selling it to us at prices we couldn't afford. This is the same in Homs. And I actually visited Homs a month after a deal which saw terrorists that had inhabited Homs, the so-called capital of the revolution, so-called. This deal had seen terrorists taken from the old city of Homs to a different area of Syria. I can't remember offhand if it was Idlib or where. The people I met in Homs in the old city told me there's one family, the Ahras family, and you might have seen them interviewed in corporate media. I was surprised, but they actually were. They suffered immensely. They were emaciated because the terrorists had come and stolen every last morsel of food from their home. They chose to stay to protect their home and their belongings. Other people left. Other people left for the fear of their lives, and they left their belongings with a priest, a Dutch priest named Father Frans van der Loot. This priest is notable of mention because he was not necessarily pro-government, and he wasn't pro-so-called rebel. He was just a priest doing his vocational duty in Homs, and he'd lived there for decades. And he started writing about what he was seeing, and very early on he said, I saw armed people amongst the protesters. So that is notable because it's not, you can't say he's a paid government propagandist, you can't say he fears for his life and he's saying this. He was writing exactly what he was seeing in the so-called capital of the revolution, at a time when people were still saying the revolution was unarmed for the first year. So Father Franz was actually assassinated, I think it was April 2014, because he refused, what I was told by locals, he refused to hand over the belongings of people who had entrusted their valuables with Father Franz, and he refused to be a part, you know, complicit with the terrorist factions within Homs. So they sat him down in a chair and they shot him in the head. So that's Homs, and I started by talking about this starvation, this myth of starvation. The starvation does occur, but again, who is the fault? And inevitably, the fault is the terrorist factions within. Another area prior, the whole media was talking about, all the human rights groups were talking about, is Yarmouk, a district of Damascus. People call it a refugee camp, but in fact, it was a large neighborhood comprising about 170,000 to 200,000 Palestinians and about over 1 million Syrians living together as, you know, brother and sister and neighbor. And it was apparently a very nice neighborhood. People used to go there for shopping. At some point, terrorist factions did enter Yarmouk, and it became a security, it became an area where terrorists were firing on the people of Yarmouk, and being so close to Damascus, it became a very important security priority. However, it was the Palestinian security is the Palestinian soldiers who took care of security in Yarmouk, because that was always the agreement. Yet the Syrian government was accused of destroying Yarmouk. The Syrian government was accused of starving the people of Yarmouk. And there are actually videos. You can see a British reporter from, I think it was Sky News, joining people in Yarmouk who were protesting against the presence of the terrorist factions. And these people were attacked by terrorists firing upon them. There are other things that you can find online that the Red Cross said they were trying to send aid into Yarmouk, but the terrorists prevented it. So the same scenario has played out throughout Syria. If we fast forward to September of this year, there was a ceasefire, which the Syrians agreed to and the Russians agreed to, and the Syrians and the Russians adhered to. But right from the start, 20 main terrorist factions said, we're not taking a part in this. So basically, the Syrians and Russians were supposed to stop battling terrorism, and the terrorists were free to run amok and fire upon Syrian civilians and the army. By the end of the ceasefire, the Russian center for, I'd have to remember the name, in Hamaymim, I'm forgetting the name right now, I want to say reconciliation. Anyway, the Russians documented over 300 ceasefire violations by the terrorist factions. At the beginning of this ceasefire, the terrorists actually came out and protested and said, we don't want food aid to come into here. We don't want food, we want weapons. Meanwhile, it's the Syrian government who's accused of starving people in eastern areas of Aleppo. Now, if we fast forward to the present day, this past week has seen, as I mentioned, immense advances with the Syrian army securing these areas of eastern Aleppo that were occupied by terrorist factions. And there's so much photo and video documentation, testimonies of people saying exactly what people in Madaya said and Yarmouk said, the terrorists stole our food. And there's also, you can see videos online of actual buildings where you can find stockpiles of medicine that were being deprived, the people were being deprived of, the terrorists had control of it. Stockpiles of food, stockpiles of weapons, stockpiles of chemicals used to make chemical weapons and fire upon the people in the army. The myths that the Western media, the human rights groups, the Western leadership have used also, so in addition to killing their people, starving their people, the media has said that for some reason the government wants to destroy its own hospitals. Just using your brain, a government wouldn't want to destroy its own hospital, no matter how bloodthirsty you think they may be. It's just illogical. It's the government's hospital. They're going to have to rebuild it. It's their own money. But that, you know, logic aside, every time they make a claim, they haven't been able to back it. And for example, in April this year, they said the Russians or the Syrians destroyed a hospital named Al-Quds. And they said it was flattened by aerial bombing or something. Actually, their stories contradicted one another. Some said aerial bombing, some said barrel bombs, some said artillery fire. In fact, the Russians showed satellite imagery showing in the hospital was in the same state, the same physical state, as it had been in October 2015. So if it had been attacked, somehow it was still physically the same structure. So therefore, it wasn't attacked. Yet all the media ran with that. They said Syria is destroying its hospitals, and Syria was again vilified, and so was Russia. Because at this point, remember that in late September, the Syrian government invited Russia to come into Syria and to fight terrorism. And so ever since that point, ever since the first, before the first Russian plane came into Syrian skies, there were stories about Russians killing civilians. So these stories about hospital attacks have been fabricated in order to vilify the government and to vilify Russia. But in fact, now I have a number of photos and slides that I'm going to show you. I actually want to show just some of the photos first. Can you show the photo of a hospital? I think you have it. There, on May 3rd, the maternity hospital in Greater Aleppo, its name is Dabit, it was, see which number that would be. It was attacked, actually there's a photo actually of a hospital structure. There we go. That's the Dabit hospital. Now, terrorists fired a rocket which landed on a parked car outside the hospital, which exploded two neighboring cars and gutted the hospital and killed three women inside. Media didn't talk about this, even though three women were killed, and the media was always talking about last hospitals and last maternity hospitals and last pediatricians. They didn't care that this hospital was attacked. And other hospitals have been attacked. Roughly two-thirds of Syria's state hospitals have been attacked and damaged by terrorist factions. One of the more notable ones you might be aware of is the Kindi Hospital, which in late 2013 was truck-bombed and destroyed by terrorist factions. And, you know, the Kindi Hospital was the best and largest cancer treatment hospital in the Middle East. Yet, not only did the media really not largely talk about this, more recently they've used photos of the Kindi Hospital and they said this is in eastern Aleppo and the Syrian regime has bombed it. So this is how blatant some of their lies have been. Other lies, as I mentioned, have contradicted one another, saying some days saying there's only 10 doctors left, some days saying there's 17 doctors left. This whole last doctor, last clown, absurdly enough, was one of the more recent ones. These are meant to pull on heartstrings of people outside who aren't closely following the lies of the corporate media. So they hear this and they think, oh my God, we need to do something. And always the answers of these complicit human rights groups and complicit so-called anti-war groups and complicit so-called independent media Democracy Now, the call to do something is answered with no-fly zone. Absurdly, even after the example of Libya, which has been destroyed by such a no-fly zone and Western bombing, absurdly, people are expected to believe that a no-fly zone in Syria is going to bring peace. It's absolutely not going to bring peace. What Syrians want is an end to the terrorism. Can you show that clip now of the woman? I want to show you.
Here in Aleppo, we face this every day. Here in Aleppo, we face bombs every day. But we have very, very power to live here. And we have... how can I express for you the feeling? We can't leave our city here. We can't leave our city for these people which they want to take our land, which they come from out of our country. They want to kill us. They want to take our country. We can't leave this. Really, I can't hold any arms to fight with army or something else. But I can fight when I stay in my home, when I stay in my city, when I try to change anything bad. But as you see, the situation is very bad.
You can't take arms, but do you support the army?
I support the army because he defends for our country.
Now, we're in the university area where there's residences for displaced people. Are you living here?
No.
No?
No. I'm living in a place which you can call it in the face of this Al-Nusra.
Eh.
My home in the face of the building of them.
What area?
Sifat Dawli.
Alhamdulillah Salama.
Allah Yisalmik. Every day, some children, they killed by snipers. Every day, a lot of people killed by bombs. Every day by Jarrat al-Ghaz. Every day. But we're still there, and we're still living there. And we want to live there. We don't want to leave our country. Because these people are not Syrian. These people, they have the money to kill us and to take our money and to take our city. But we are not going to leave them to take this. Anyway, we support our Syrian army because really they do the best to keep our country.
So she said Jarrat al-Ghaz, and I mentioned gas canister. So basically terrorists have made a very effective and deadly bomb by simply using a gas canister. These, by the way, were photos I took. I went to visit Nubal and Zahra, which were two villages north of Aleppo that had been besieged for 3.5 years and suffered starvation, want of medicine, and also daily bombardment by terrorists. And in between Aleppo and Nubal and Zahra, to the north and west slightly, the countryside was littered with these gas canisters. And these are spent gas canister bombs, and these are the kind that are falling daily on the people of Aleppo. Let's see if I can get this thing to work. Ooh. That's actually in the district of Leramun, which is in the north of Aleppo, and it was an industrial district which I visited twice. And actually, Leramun was occupied among terrorist factions by the so-called FSA. And the FSA, you know, the West likes to make them out to be moderates, because according to Western logic, only al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, and ISIS are terrorists, according to them. But we know that the FSA has been as barbaric and heinous, barbaric to use Samantha Power's word, and heinous as ISIS and Nusra, as have Ahrar al-Sham and Nur al-Din Zinki and other terrorist factions. So this was in July, my first visit to Aleppo. There was some sort of bomb. I don't actually know if it was a gas canister or a water heater bomb, but it hit the train station in Mahatat Baghdad, and it was about half a kilometer away. And then maybe 10 minutes later, roughly from here to that wall, so 10, 15 meters, I'm Canadian, I'm sorry, an explosive bullet landed not far away. Explosive bullets may not create as much physical damage, but obviously if they land on you, they will kill you. This one landed far enough away, and it had already exploded in the air. It didn't do any damage. But a day later, one hit the mother of a dear friend, and she was killed. These are the types of things you aren't hearing about unless you're seeking out, you know, from friends in Syria, from Syrian media sources, or trusted independent sources. This bench, actually not exactly this bench, it would have been one to the right. This is in one of Aleppo's main parks. And I remember after my first July visit, I remember reading that there had been a woman killed, and she was sitting on the bench with another woman and a child. And it was a Friday afternoon, and terrorists basically fired rockets throughout the city, and one of the rockets landed right near where they were sitting. And there's a ghastly picture showing the two women and the child draped on the bench, murdered by this. And they're in a public park, and I think one thing to note about the park is that, you know, in summertime in Syria, it's obviously very hot. Many of the displaced people that have fled terrorist areas are staying in very cramped quarters with relatives or in shelters. And so they go to the parks during the day to escape the heat and to change, you know, the mentality. So they're in a park, they've already fled terrorist areas, and even in the park, they're targeted. So I was asking security, this is one of the, you can kind of get a sense of how big this is. This is from one of the mortars or gas canisters or missiles. The park was littered with holes like this, and I asked the security there, and they estimated at least 40 in the last few years have hit the park. Just to give you a sense of how a place which should be, you know, safe and children are playing there is targeted. Now, this is in the university hospital. This boy was injured, you can't really see in this photo, but he was injured by sniping, which went through his stomach. And I believe he was standing, if I remember correctly, near the water tank, either outside or on his house. But the point was, he was at home and he was sniped by one of the terrorist factions who are bringing freedom and democracy to Syria. This woman was one of people who were injured on November 3rd. Now, on November 3rd, I was in Aleppo with some, there was a delegation of Western journalists from New York Times, LA Times, BBC, and then some other independents. I'm not sure all the papers they were with. On November 3rd, we were meeting with the director of Razi Hospital, Dr. Mohamed Batikh, and he was telling us about the state of hospitals in Aleppo. He said 20 of 40 hospitals in Aleppo are functioning. He mentioned the effect of Western sanctions on, and everywhere I went, I asked about the effects of the criminal Western sanctions on Syria. He said, you know, because of the sanctions, you can't get replacement part for vital hospital equipment. And you can't even get technicians because a lot of the equipment is from Europe. And he was also talking about other things they were lacking due to the sanctions. For example, you know, the issue of chemical weapons, just to get on a side note here, Syria has been accused over and over again, falsely, of using chemical weapons against civilians. One of the more notable ones was in 2013, and it was supposed to be Obama's red line, in which, after which, you know, having supposedly proven that Syria had used chemical weapons for what reason, that the U.S. would then get to have its no-fly zone. In fact, the UN, Syria asked for a UN investigative team to come. They came, and in the end, they decided that, in fact, it was the so-called rebels that had used sarin in the area of Ghouta, or in the area of, sorry, Khan al-Asad. And over the years, there have been accusations of chemical weapons, never proven, and always it's been the terrorists that have been using them. When I was in University Hospital in November, I was actually in the emergency room, and I saw people being treated for some sort of chemical weapon, gas, sorry. So they believed it was mustard. The point I was going to make is that when we were talking with Dr. Batik, on November 3rd, there were a series of coordinated terrorist attacks. So car bombings, Grad missiles, a barrage of Grad missiles, and then mortars, explosive bullets, and snipings. And as we spoke with them, we heard word, you know, they heard word that some of the victims were had been exposed to some sort of chemical gas. And we asked, you know, has this happened before? And he said, yes. And he said, we think it's chlorine and we think it's mustard. And they said, one of the journalists said, well, why don't you know? And he said, well, we don't have the facilities to actually determine this. And one of the reasons for that is the sanctions. But the fact is that they have been exposed to gas attacks. And again, fast forward to current day, I mentioned that amongst the weapons storage piles, journalists have found large vats of chemicals used to make gas used in attacks. Now, on November 3rd, this was in the Razi Hospital, and this woman was devastated because her only son had been critically injured, and she kept shrieking for somebody to do something, and kept shrieking that it was her only son. And, you know, she's obviously in immense grief. That day, as we stood outside the hospital, the ambulances and vehicles kept rolling in with more maimed people, maimed women, some soldiers. The hospitals generally only treat civilians. There are military hospitals, but the attacks on soldiers that day had been so immense that some were coming to the civilian hospitals as well. But the majority were civilians, and by the end of the day, 18 civilians were killed and over 200 injured. And after some hours, or even less than some hours, after an hour, we learned that her son actually had died of his critical injuries. I'm sorry, I usually like to give a warning. Go back. The next couple of photos are a bit graphic. These are people, we went to the morgue around the side of the hospital at Razi, and bodies were brought in. And the point I'd like to make is, this is graphic. And you won't see it in our media, not necessarily because it's graphic, but because this is the reality. But another point is that children should not have to see this, but they are seeing it because their loved ones, their parents, their brothers, their uncles, their mothers, whatever, are dying. And as we were standing there at the morgue and there was a group of women and children, you know, mourning their uncle or father or husband, these bodies were brought in and brought into the morgue. So these kids are just standing there and being exposed to this, you know, and this is another aspect, the psychological war on people in Syria. And these were civilians, all victims of the terrorist attacks on November 3rd alone. Now, again, the numbers that you hear, there's a numbers game going on in Syria. I spoke about, I haven't yet. So when I spoke about Madaya, what I didn't highlight was that all the media said the starving people in Madaya, it was 40,000. Numbers are always inflated to make things more dramatic. And with the example of Aleppo, for years, the United Nations has been saying 270,000 or 300, but 250,000, 270,000 starving civilians in eastern Aleppo is what they've been saying. Now we've seen 93% at least of Aleppo liberated, and numbers have varied. I heard earlier this week that 100,000 people had been secured. Now I've heard it's 78,000, which is even more impressive actually, in the sense that even if it was 100,000 people that have been liberated from eastern areas of Aleppo and it's 93% liberated, that means in the remaining 7%, we're expected to believe there are 170,000 people, according to the United Nations. But in fact, now apparently the number is 78,000. So let's say 80,000 people have been liberated. That means we're expected to believe 190,000 people are in the remaining 7% of areas occupied by terrorists. So the numbers issue is very important because people have been believing, oh my God, 270,000 people starving in eastern Aleppo, we must do something. And again, you know what that something is, it's the no-fly zone. On November 4th, we went to the Castella Road. We went to, there are 8 humanitarian crossings that were opened in October and then again on November 4th. The idea with these crossings was that, yes, there is a military siege on the terrorists in eastern areas of Aleppo. And the reason is they want to trap the terrorists, get the terrorists to lay down their weapons. They want to put an end to the terrorist bombardment of civilian areas. And the government and the Russians were giving as much opportunities as they could to enable civilians to leave, also militants to leave. There were crossings that were for militants. If they wanted safe passage to Idlib, they would be guaranteed safe passage to go join terrorists in Idlib. If they wanted to take the amnesty and join the reconciliation process, which thousands of militants have done, they had that option. And if civilians wanted to leave, in theory they had that option, but the fact has been the terrorist factions within have prevented civilians from leaving. And again, you can find ample documentation of this online, of terrorists firing on civilians. In this case, in the morning we went to the Bustan al-Qasr crossing, which is in near the old city of Aleppo, and we're there for a bit and nobody came out. By the end of the day, nobody also had left. And we went to the Castella Road humanitarian crossing, which is kind of the north of the city. And Castella Road was the way I entered Aleppo in August. When we were there on November 4th at the crossing, there were about 10 ambulances there. Some were state ambulances, some were private that had come at the request of the government. The idea, they were there in case people who left these areas needed medical treatment they hadn't been able to get for months. There were buses to transport people. While we were standing there, terrorists shelled the crossing twice. The second one was so close that security made us leave for our own safety. And by the end of the day, it was shelled five more times. So this was clearly coming, the shells were coming from a terrorist area, and their intent was clearly to make it impossible for civilians to use that crossing. Because essentially what people have called it is one of the biggest hostage crises ever. They're using the civilian population, or they were until more recently, to ensure that the Syrian army couldn't fully liberate these areas. Because if you want to believe the corporate media, well then the army would have just done what people in Aleppo were saying, just blast the whole area, please, we want an end to this terrorism, just destroy it. But the army said, no, we're not going to do that. We have to go slowly to ensure that we can save civilians. And they opened the corridors to ensure that civilians could get out. But the terrorists saw this as a means of ensuring their own safety by holding them prisoner. On a second visit to Aleppo in November, my fourth visit there, I actually met a family from an area that had been occupied and recently liberated. It's called El Halak. And they had fled sometime in late October. I met them on November 10th, and they told me basically they had tried twice prior to leave, and the terrorists had forced them to stay. They hadn't let them leave. And I asked them, why do they want to leave? Obviously, they said the same things we're hearing. We had no food. We couldn't afford the food that the terrorists were selling at prices that were, you know, half our salaries, if we even have a salary. And they wouldn't sell them meat, only rice and barley. So they wanted to leave to improve their life, to be able to get medical care, and to get away from the terrorists. I've said that 93% of the areas are liberated. So if you are following this and you're looking online, there are so many testimonies saying exactly that. And yet, this corporate media, again, Democracy Now!, New York Times, and British media, are insisting that people who have fled terrorists and come to the safety of government-secured Aleppo, they're twisting the story. They're saying they're fleeing from the Syrian army, or they're saying they're manufacturing stories, even though there's so many testimonies to say the contrary. That was the shelling that occurred on Castella Road. This is the man that I interviewed. At the time, he said he didn't want to show his face because his brother was still in eastern Aleppo, or eastern areas of Aleppo, occupied. And his brother hadn't been able to leave, so he was worried about his safety, so he didn't want to identify himself. Now I'm going to make this point. When I talk about media sources, sometimes it's acceptable to say, you know, Abu Shuzmo, they don't want to say their actual name for security reasons. And this is one instance of that. But what the corporate media has done in their attempts to paint a different different image of Aleppo and Syria in general is to consistently cite unnamed sources. Every time, unnamed sources, unnamed sources, unnamed activists. Once in a while it's credible, but when you're doing it all the time, you lose your credibility. The other places they've cited, or the other people they've cited, are the group by Mr. Rami Abdurrahman, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. It's a nice fancy name, but it's a one-man show based in the UK, who he himself relies on unnamed sources, and he also relies on something a member of the audience asked me to talk about, which I was planning on, the White Helmets. So has anyone heard of the White Helmets? Yeah, well, you know what? That's more than people in Aleppo have heard of the White Helmets. Almost nobody in Aleppo has heard of them. The only people I met that had heard of them were people who had done research and were taking an interest in the corporate media propaganda and, you know, all the propaganda about Syria. The average person in Aleppo hasn't heard of the White Helmets. And you might say, well, in Greater Aleppo, you know, they wouldn't, because the White Helmets only work in Nusra-occupied areas. They're embedded with terrorists. You might say that. But people in you know, greater areas of Aleppo still have loved ones in the eastern areas that were occupied, and they communicate with them. They, you know, they're worried about their safety. So if the White Helmets were present and saving people as they claim to be doing, then the relatives that are in these eastern areas would have said, you know, yeah, there's White Helmets. But nobody I met had heard of them, including people that had relatives there, including the man that I interviewed, who never heard of them, White what? They also go by the name Syria Civil Defense. This is, again, their whole package is to imply that they're rescuers, they're grassroots volunteers, they're, you know, the good guys that are saving people being bombarded by any number of things. For example, they say Russian airstrikes now, when Russia has said they haven't committed any airstrikes on Syria since October, I believe it was 18th, let's say late October. And yet, if you look at the White Helmets' Facebook page or their website or any of their propaganda videos, they'll continue to say Russian airstrikes. But the other point to note is that now, with almost all of the eastern areas of Aleppo liberated, nobody of the people coming out of there have heard of the White Helmets, because people, journalists, are asking them. They want to know, do these people exist? And the other thing is, now 1,000 militants have left. This was yesterday, so it might be more now. Have left these eastern areas, and you know, I think it was something like 960 or something like that of them have taken the amnesty. So if say 80,000 people have left, 1,000 militants have left, and there's say 7% left to liberate, where are the White Helmets? Now, the White Helmets, one other thing about them is, again, they purport to be neutral defenders, grassroots, but they have funding of at least $100 million. And I'd really like you to not just take my word for it, but to look into the research of Vanessa Beely, who's a colleague of mine and a dear friend, and who spent a year and a half researching these characters called the White Helmets. And she found that between the UK Foreign Office, the US, and the EU, and certain other states, they do have at least $100 million in funding. Why do they need that much money to run to rescue people? If you watch any of their propaganda videos, their uniforms are almost, I've never seen a bloodied uniform. And you know, I lived in Gaza and I used to ride with the Red Crescent during the 2008-2009 Israeli assault on Gaza. And I can attest to you that a rescuer's uniform is always bloodied and they're always changing it, but it's bloodied right away and it's dusty. These uniforms are always pristinely white. It's beyond believable, in fact. The other point about them is that they can be seen in their Facebook profiles holding weapons. They can be seen in their own videos standing on the dead bodies of Syrian soldiers. So if they exist, if they were in Aleppo, what's happened is they are of terrorist factions, and sometimes they put on a white helmet for their propaganda videos, and other times they're committing the acts of terrorism. But they've been very effective. This propaganda has been so effective that they were almost granted the Nobel Peace Prize, which would have been keeping with tradition in granting criminals peace prizes, yes. But the fact is that this really legitimized them in the eyes of people. And until now, Avaaz and other, you know, GoFundMe, I'm not sure what other fundraising campaigns are still raising money. And they've done speaking tours and they're raising money for their ridiculous and you know, deadly propaganda, because this propaganda leads people to be confused about Syria and potentially to support a no-fly zone, which would actually be very deadly. I'll just move on. I talked about some of the compromised media sources. Another one, there have been a number that have sprung up since 2011 and in later years. One is called the Aleppo Media Center. And if you're on Facebook, you'll see this one bandied about a lot. You'll see some more slick videos and it'll have the AMC logo. This one is also funded by the French Foreign Office, the UK Foreign Office, the USA. And they also have, you know, the same kind of propaganda in which they're accusing the Syrians and the Russians of being so bloodthirsty they just rampantly go out and kill people. Now, this is a war. Syria is fighting a war against terrorism, and there are civilian losses. Nobody's denying that. But what these creatures are purporting is absurd. The Syrian government has, from the very beginning, shown a willingness for a political solution. I think it was mid-2011, President Assad gave a speech in Damascus University, so not even in the parliament or, you know, appropriate political venue, but in a university, appealing to people saying, what are the reforms you want? What can we do? We need to be united. The Syrians realized, at least maybe not from the very beginning, but they do now realize that this is a war against Syria. And they are very much united, except for those who, for whatever reason, have taken up arms. Some of them have, you know, a political agenda, which is not very bright. Some of them have maybe another agenda through their, you know, Muslim Brotherhood or Wahhabi backers. Some of them are playing out mercenaries and getting paid. Some of them have been forced into it. And it's actually, I believe, the ones that have laid down their weapons over the years and taken the amnesty, the reconciliation, probably these are the people that have been either forced into it, maybe thought they could be someone powerful and important, but realized, you know, they're not going to achieve whatever goals they thought they had, or realized that this is a chance for them to escape from the hell of being a mercenary. Others continue to absurdly state, and other people continue to absurdly state that there was a revolution ever in Syria, and that they continue to state that exists now. One of the main myths is that from the beginning, the government was heavy-handed and, you know, shot down unarmed protesters because they just didn't like a dissent. Now, actually, what I've heard from people in Syria, all over Syria, is that from the very beginning, the protests were sectarian. And this isn't to say that every person that wanted political change in Syria was sectarian, nor that every person that wanted political change in Syria was violent. But amongst the protesters, there were these two elements. The elements of calling for Alawis to be murdered and Christians to be expelled, and the elements of people holding weapons and shooting against unarmed security forces, as was the case in Daraa. Yet you have the Yasser Muneefs and the revolution supporters in the West, and you have all these corporate media and so-called independent media that continue to say civil war, and it's not a civil war, continue to say revolutionary, democratic uprising, and it's none of those things. And really, you know, don't take my word for it. I mean, this is an informed audience. I don't think I need to say that. But every person I've spoken to has said this is not a revolution. And if you just use simple logic, what kind of revolution starts in a border town bordering your enemy, the State of Israel? What kind of revolution destroys its own infrastructure and kills its own people? If it's a revolution, you target the government. You don't target the people. And I mean, I spent weeks and weeks in my various stays in Syria. When I wasn't traveling around the country, I stayed in the old city, mostly in the East Gate, Bab Sharqi, or in Bab Tuma, Thomas Gate. And in 2014 and 15, the mortars being fired from Jobar and Ghouta were intense. And they still are firing. It's not quite as heavy. But again, why are they firing on civilian areas? Why are they hitting schools? What kind of revolution does this? They say it's to punish people for supporting the government, but that's not a revolutionary act. It's clear that what's happening in Syria has nothing to do about human rights, and it's clear that all the crocodile tears of the West have nothing to do with human rights. And even earlier this week, a representative of Canada at the United Nations introduced legislation in the General Assembly to basically vilify Syria and Russia. Because a few days prior, in the Security Council, Russia and China had vetoed a resolution calling for another ceasefire. Now, I mentioned how the September ceasefire was violated at least 300 times by terrorist factions who refused to participate in it. It was also violated by the US-led coalition, which attacked an army position in Deir ez-Zor, killing at least 83 soldiers in an attack that lasted almost 1 hour, and which enabled ISIS to take over. This is not the first time U.S. coalition activities in Syria and bombings in Syria and blind eyes in Syria have allowed ISIS to take over. We have Palmyra as an example, and repeated accidental airdrops of supplies to ISIS. So this resolution that Canada introduced and that was unfortunately passed in the GA I met with Ambassador Al-Jafri earlier this week, and he made some, I mean, he always makes good points. He's a very articulate spokesperson for Syria. And he said, you know, the resolution itself, the fact that they pulled this stunt in the General Assembly was in contrast, it contradicted the UN Charter itself. These resolutions have to take place in the Security Council unless the Security Council deems it necessary to take place in the General Assembly. But Canada, you know, ran off to the General Assembly and the UN allowed it to do so. And the resolution was passed. And, you know, this is one example of many which shows that the UN itself has been, from the very beginning, complicit in what's happening in Syria. With regards to Ambassador Al-Jafri, there are some maybe more minor examples, but he's repeatedly cut off, or his mic is cut, or the video feed is cut, or his time is cut when he's speaking about Syria, and he's the ambassador of Syria. And with in terms of legalities, there have been numerous resolutions passed, for example, 2253, which state that you know, this is a resolution against the arming and funding of terrorists in Syria. And if it were not for, you know, the Gulf money and the U.S. money and the U.S. funding of what they call moderates, and if it were not for Turkey flooding these moderates into Syria to murder people, this war on Syria would have ended long ago. So the hypocrisy of the U.N. in, you know, allowing this resolution to be passed, but nobody actually enforces it. This is one of many elements which show the U.N. is complicit in the war on Syria. The Western leaders obviously are, the Western media are as complicit as those who are murdering, because their lies are leading to more people to misunderstand and potentially endorse these no-fly zones. I'll wrap it up, but I do just want to note a couple more things. I mentioned displaced people in Aleppo, and I don't think I need to really explain it to this crowd, but you know, our media always talks about refugees. Yes, there are 4 or 5 million refugees that have left Syria for varying reasons. Some have left because they are against the government. Some have left because they're in areas where terrorists occupied and they fled. Some have left for economic reasons. Many have left, hundreds of thousands have left for economic reasons. The sanctions and the war on Syria has devastated the economy. And in months I've spent throughout Lebanon, I've met many of these people who left Syria. They want to go back, they long to go back, but they need to support their family. But what media don't talk about are the 6 million internal refugees that have, for whatever reasons, left their cities, their areas, and gone to hubs like Latakia and Tartus and Damascus and Ceuta. You have refugees in Ceuta, an area that's predominantly Druze, that come from Raqqa or come from Dara, which is Sunni. You know, so this kind of highlights two things. One, they're fleeing areas where there's fighting with the terrorists or fighting, you know, attacks from the terrorists, and they're fleeing to the Syrian government secured areas. So if they're so afraid of the government, why are they doing this? And the other point is it just shows how much unity there is in Syria and how much non-sectarianism there is in Syria. Every person I met identifies themselves as a Suri. Before they, you know, if I press them, then they'll say what their faith is. But this sectarianism has been sent by Saudis, by the Muslim Brotherhood, and by the West and Turkey. And unfortunately, our media tries to paint what's happening in Syria as a Sunni-Shia thing, or Sunnis against Alawis, or Sunnis against the Alawi government. This is all nonsense. Syria is a very pluralistic society. And Syrians that I've met, again, throughout Syria, are very proud of the fact that they celebrate their neighbors' faiths and they share holidays and they intermarry. So this issue of sectarianism and the issue of internal refugees fleeing to government secured areas and being provided shelter and food and medical care, etc., is very important, and it's not talked about in the corporate media. Just as the sanctions are not talked about and the sanctions need to end, and just as the overwhelming will of the people of Syria is not talked about, and that will, from what I've experienced, from what other people who have traveled to Syria have experienced, and from what is shown in the fact that when they held elections, they voted for their president. The will that I've seen and that I believe is that the Syrian people support their president and support their army, and they've said this is not about Assad. Again, we want political change, we want reforms, there have been reforms, we want more reforms, but everything that's happening in Syria isn't about Assad, it isn't about human rights, and They say, please tell the truth when you go there, back to your country. Please tell them that the terrorists are killing us. Tell them that we just want everything to go back to how it was. They've said this so much.
I remember being on a program in Chicago, ABC Television Network, and the debate was with one of the top people at the AMA and myself, debating the benefits of fiber. I remember one of the statements that this man made was that, well, fiber is good for pigs and cows, but humans really don't need a lot of it. Indeed, at that time, the average American was consuming under 5 grams of fiber a day. Needless to say, constipation and diverticular conditions were rampant. What if you were to hear that interview from 1972 or 3, 45 years later? You would say, wow, that was prescient. You were ahead of the curve. And indeed now, 40 to 50 grams of fiber is necessary, plus all the good bacteria, the gut biome, and all that that does to help our immune system. But back then, nobody wanted to hear it. Medicine, science didn't believe it, didn't want to hear it. They were wrong. And that's why I thought that you would find today's interview with Eva Bartlett relevant. And also important, because she was right. The entire mainstream media was wrong. She won't be honored. She won't be acknowledged for being right. Because had we listened to her back in March 13, 2014, when this interview occurred, and we acted upon that information and did honest, independent investigations, think of the amount of suffering that could have been prevented. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Father, father, we don't need to escalate.